We continue with Special Counsel Jack Smith's brief for the United States in Donald Trump v. United States, picking up on page 31. E. The impeachment judgment clause does not make Senate conviction a prerequisite to criminal prosecution of a former president. The impeachment judgment clause provides further reason to reject petitioner's novel claim of absolute criminal immunity. That clause provides, judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. But the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law. U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 3, Clause 7. Although much of petitioner's brief is devoted to arguments that necessarily imply that a former president can never face criminal prosecution, he acknowledges, as he must, that the clause expressly contemplates such prosecutions. Petitioner attempts to reconcile that necessary concession with his position by maintaining that the clause implicitly immunizes a former president from prosecution unless he has first been impeached by the House and convicted by the Senate for the same or closely related official conduct. That argument lacks merit. 1. The text of the impeachment judgment clause affords no support for petitioner's claim. The first part of the clause limits Congress's remedies to removal of an officer and disqualification from holding office in the future. The second part of the clause explains that, despite conviction after an impeachment trial, a party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment, according to law. The text thus clarifies that an official who is impeached and convicted is nevertheless exposed to criminal prosecution in the courts of law. He has no double jeopardy defense. But as the Court of Appeals noted, the text says nothing about non-convicted officials. Petitioner's contrary assertion that the phrase party convicted in the impeachment judgment clause requires that an officer be both impeached and convicted before that officer may face criminal prosecution leads to structurally implausible results at odds with historical practice. Under his interpretation of the text, all federal officers, not just the president, would have to be impeached and convicted before prosecution. Although petitioner contends that presidents have a special status under the clause, the Constitution itself refutes that claim. The framers provided a separate rule for presidential impeachments in the immediately preceding clause, requiring the Chief Justice to preside, but wrote no similar presidential exception into the impeachment judgment clause. Petitioner's proposed rule would also raise separation of powers concerns by giving Congress a veto over the executive's decision to prosecute, a decision over which the executive branch has exclusive authority and absolute discretion. And history reflects a clear separation between impeachment and prosecution. Although scores of federal officers have been criminally prosecuted throughout our history, fewer than 24 officers have ever been impeached by the House, with only 8, all federal judges, convicted in the Senate. And in the few cases in which both procedures have been invoked, prosecution has regularly preceded impeachment. Courts have thus uniformly rejected the claim that criminal prosecution may occur only after impeachment and conviction. 2. Petitioner's contention that impeachment must precede criminal prosecution also misapprehends the distinct roles that impeachment and prosecution play under the Constitution. The impeachment process is, by design, a political remedy for the dangers to governance posed by an officeholder who has committed treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. The Constitution contemplates that Congress will weigh the need for removal of an official from office by evaluating his fitness for continued or future exercise of governmental power. That process does not depend on rigorously adjudicating facts and applying law, or on finding a criminal violation. It is inherently political. Unlike in the criminal justice system, Congress may decide not to impeach or convict for reasons that have little or no connection to the nature of the evidence or the officer's culpable conduct. The disruptive consequences of removal from office may be too great. The political alignment of Congress may prevent impeachment and conviction without regard to the officer's conduct. The culpable conduct may come to light only after the president has left office, or may occur so close to the end of the president's term that his impending departure from office makes impeachment seem less urgent. Or, as here, the impeachment trial could occur only after the president has left office, obviating the need for removal. The Senate has never convicted a former official, and senators at petitioner's impeachment trial expressed doubt about their power to do so. All of those scenarios further confirm that petitioner's novel impeachment-first theory of criminal liability is untenable. In contrast to impeachment, the criminal process produces legal, not political, results. For that reason, petitioner's extrapolation from the recent history of presidential impeachment is inept. Because impeachment is intrinsically political, experience with impeachment provides no basis for speculating that criminal prosecutions will follow the same path. And basic structural features of the federal system confirm that they will not. Prosecutions do not grow out of interbranch conflict, but proceed from institutions that apply the facts and the law. And they unfold under judicial supervision to prevent any abuses. Petitioners further claim that DOJ recognizes that the prosecution of a president is necessarily political, distorts the reasoning of the opinion he cites. The OLC opinion petitioner quotes addresses prosecution of a sitting president. Incapacitating a sitting president through criminal prosecution is tantamount to removal, and thus, prosecution in that context is, in some respects, necessarily political. Prosecution itself is not. And prosecution of a former president does not raise concerns about the impact of an incumbent president that prompted OLC's statement. To the contrary, OLC concluded that an immunity from prosecution for a sitting president would not preclude such prosecution once the president's term is over or he is otherwise removed from office by resignation or impeachment. 3. Neither historical sources nor DOJ policy supports petitioner's impeachment-first rule. Petitioner invokes three of Alexander Hamilton's essays in The Federalists, numbers 65, 69, and 77. None states that conviction by the Senate is a prerequisite to a former president's criminal prosecution. Hamilton's essays instead explained why the Supreme Court was not the proper body to serve as an impeachment court, how a president differed from the British monarch, and that despite the president's formidable powers, strong constitutional safeguards existed to protect the nation. Hamilton's discussions therefore focused on the constitutional processes for remedying misconduct by a sitting president. They do not suggest that a former president could not be prosecuted unless he was first impeached and convicted. Petitioner fares no better with his other historical sources. Petitioner contends that Chief Justice Marshall and Charles Lee, who was not Attorney General when he argued Marbury, as petitioner implies, advocated an impeachment-first rule. But that contention is premised on petitioner's flawed argument that courts cannot review a president's alleged criminal conduct under the reasoning in Marbury and its progeny. And Justice Joseph Story never endorsed the view that criminal prosecution was available only following impeachment and conviction for the same conduct. Indeed, he explicitly rejected it. Those historical sources and the DOJ materials that petitioner cites reflect the long-standing department position that although a sitting president enjoys temporary immunity from criminal prosecution, for all conduct, public and private, he may be prosecuted after leaving office. Contrary to petitioner's implication, neither OLC nor former Solicitor General Robert Bork expressed the view that impeachment and conviction were conditions precedent to federal criminal prosecution of a president. They instead reasoned that once a president has left office, whether through impeachment and conviction, resignation, or the end of his term, he may face federal criminal prosecution like any other citizen. Their conclusions, therefore, accord with Chief Justice Marshall's statement that the president is elected from the mass of the people and, on the expiration of the time for which he is elected, returns to the mass of the people again. F. Petitioner's understanding of Marbury and his other remaining arguments lack merit. 1. Relying on the vesting clause, U.S. Constitution Article 2, Section 1, Clause 1, and Marbury, petitioner argues that a president's official conduct can never be examinable by the courts. But petitioner's position that a president may be criminally prosecuted following an impeachment and Senate conviction is fundamentally inconsistent with his reading of Marbury. He admits that courts can examine official presidential acts if the former president has been impeached and convicted. If the judiciary can directly examine a former president's official acts in that context, Article III courts unquestionably have the constitutional authority and capacity to preside over such prosecutions. Petitioner's interpretation of Marbury also fails on its own terms. It is true that courts cannot enter an injunction against a sitting president directing his performance of official acts. But that protection against judicial direction of the president's ongoing conduct of office does not suggest that courts are disabled from holding a former president accountable when his actions violate federal criminal law. The exercise of judicial power to review presidential acts in certain circumstances dates from the early years of the Republic and continues to this day. Petitioner suggests that the review of official presidential acts takes place through the actions against the president's subordinates because of judicial incapacity to exercise any authority directly over the president's official acts. That claim contradicts the passage from Marbury on which he repeatedly relies, which discussed review of a subordinate's acts as an agent for the president. Beyond that, the principle applies to judicial control over the president's ongoing administration of the government. It has nothing to do with potential criminal prosecution once the president has left office. Petitioner likewise derives no support from Mississippi v. Johnson, 1867. There, the court held that it could not issue an injunction to control the president's enforcement of the Reconstruction Acts. But the court declined to express any opinion on the broader issues, whether in any case the president of the United States may be required, by the process of this court, to perform a purely ministerial act under a positive law, or may be held amenable in any case otherwise than by impeachment for crime. Johnson's holding that a sitting president's acts are not susceptible to injunctions against him in his official capacity, therefore says nothing about whether a former president can be prosecuted under federal criminal law. Finally, Fitzgerald's civil immunity ruling is not a bookend to Marshall's ruling in Marbury. Fitzgerald, in fact, reaffirmed that courts can exercise jurisdiction over the president and mentioned Marbury only in a footnote to refute an argument advanced by the dissent. And more recently, this court invoked Marbury for precisely the opposite of the rule petitioner urges, stating that when the president takes official action, the court has the authority to determine whether he has acted within the law. The court supported that statement by citing Youngstown, which it described as an application of the principle established in Marbury that it is emphatically the province and duty of the Judicial Department to say what the law is. The actual historical bookends that govern this case are Chief Justice Marshall's decision in Burr through the court's decision in Vance. Each decision applies the principle that presidents are amenable to judicial process and that no person is above the law. 2. Petitioner contends that the lack of any prosecutions of former presidents until this case reflects the settled conclusion that criminal immunity precludes such a prosecution. But this prosecution is a historical first, not because of any assumption about immunity, but instead because of the singular gravity of the alleged conduct. The indictment describes petitioner's efforts to remain in power despite losing the 2020 election. The severity, range, and democracy-damaging nature of the alleged crimes are unique in American history. Other than former President Nixon, whose pardon precluded criminal prosecution, petitioner can point to no former president alleged to have engaged in remotely similar conduct. In listing presidential conduct that he asserts was criminal, petitioner makes no effort to examine the specifics of any criminal statutes, consider relevant legal defenses, or address the threshold requirement that the admissible evidence will probably be sufficient to obtain and sustain a conviction. Accusations leveled in political discourse do not constitute evidence. Petitioner's examples also fail to prove his point. Even if it is true that John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay agreed to exchange political support for an appointment following the election of 1824, Adams was a presidential candidate, not the president, and petitioner fails to explain how the asserted political deal constituted a crime, a proposal to trade one public act for another, a form of logrolling, is fundamentally unlike the swap of an official act for a private payment. Petitioner likewise identifies no court order or criminal statute that would have applied to President Jackson's decision not to send federal forces to prevent Georgia officials from interfering with the Cherokee following this court's decision in Worcester v. Virginia, 1832. Petitioner's 20th and 21st century examples are similarly flawed. He identifies no criminal statutes that could have validly applied to President Roosevelt's decision to intern Japanese Americans during World War II, President Clinton's decision to launch military strikes in the Middle East, or President Obama's decision to launch a drone strike abroad. Those examples involved quintessential exercises of the president's commander-in-chief power during war, or to protect the nation from foreign threats. Attempts by Congress to regulate the president's exercise of those authorities through the criminal laws would raise the sort of serious separation of powers concerns that are absent here. And petitioner's assertion that President Clinton engaged in an illegal quid pro quo, granting a pardon in exchange for a thing of value, rests on speculation. Finally, petitioner makes no effort to support his contentions that President George W. Bush made knowingly false statements about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or that any of the conduct he ascribes to President Biden would violate a criminal law. 3. Petitioner's invocation of common law immunity doctrine is misplaced. The court has acknowledged that common law immunity doctrine is of limited use because the presidency did not exist through most of the development of common law. And critically, for judges and prosecutors, absolute civil immunity has never implied criminal immunity. The court has instead reasoned that despite absolute immunity from civil damages claims, judges and prosecutors are subject to criminal prosecutions, as are other citizens. The recognition that civil immunity does not imply criminal immunity for these official acts has deep roots in the law, and it equally applies here. Indeed, exposure to criminal liability is one of the justifications for civil immunity. Criminal prosecutions ensure that, despite immunity from private civil damages actions, official misconduct is adequately punished and deterred. Accordingly, this court has never held that the performance of the duties of judicial, legislative, or executive officers requires or contemplates the immunization of otherwise criminal deprivation of constitutional rights. On the contrary, the judicially fashioned doctrine of official immunity does not reach so far as to immunize criminal conduct proscribed by an act of Congress. Likewise, the Speech or Debate Clause, U.S. Constitution Article 1, Section 6, Clause 1, does not support petitioner's immunity claim. No similar textual immunity applies to presidents, and history explains the distinctive reasons for protecting legislators. The clause arose in response to British kings' use of the criminal and civil law to suppress and intimidate critical legislators, where judges were often lackeys of the Stuart monarchs. That history of interbranch abuse against legislators has no parallel here, and structural safeguards protect against any such abuses with respect to potential criminal prosecution of former presidents under federal law. Part 2. Even if a former president has some immunity from federal criminal prosecution for official acts, this prosecution should proceed. Even assuming that a former president is entitled to some immunity for official acts, that immunity should not be held to bar this prosecution. First, a president's alleged criminal scheme to overturn an election and thwart the peaceful transfer of power to his lawfully elected successor is the paradigmatic example of conduct that should not be immunized, even if other conduct should be. Second, at the core of the charged conspiracies is a private scheme with private actors to achieve a private end. Petitioner's effort to remain in power by fraud. Those allegations of private misconduct are more than sufficient to support the indictment. Thus, even if the court determines that some form of official act immunity exists and may apply to some acts alleged in this case, the court should remand so the district court can address the issues through evidentiary and instructional rulings at trial. A. No form of official immunity should preclude trial on the indictment in this case. This case should be remanded for trial because any novel immunity from criminal liability for a former president's official acts should not apply to the allegations in this case. A president's alleged criminal scheme to use his official powers to overturn the presidential election and thwart the peaceful transfer of power frustrates core constitutional provisions that protect democracy. These provisions include the Term of Office Clause, U.S. Constitution Article 2, Section 1, Clause 1, for the provision of electing presidents, and the Installation of Successor provision in the 20th Amendment. Petitioner's concern about chilling official conduct that violates those provisions rings hollow because no president has an Article 2 interest in using crimes to give himself a second term after an election he lost. Nor would it be a gerrymandered approach to focus on the specific allegations that petitioner conspired with others to overturn the legitimate results of the 2020 presidential election by using knowingly false claims of election fraud. To the contrary, a holding that petitioner has no immunity from the alleged crimes would suffice to resolve this case, leaving potentially more difficult questions that might arise on different facts for decision if they are ever presented. B. Any remand should permit the district court to make evidentiary and instructional rulings at trial. Even if the court were inclined to recognize some immunity for a former president's official acts, it should remand for trial because the indictment alleges substantial private conduct in the service of petitioner's private aim. The district court can make evidentiary rulings and craft appropriate jury instructions for trial, clarifying that petitioner may be held criminally liable based only on the private conduct alleged in the indictment, even though the jury could consider official acts evidence for limited and specified purposes. 1. Petitioner's use of official power was merely an additional means of achieving a private aim, to perpetuate his term in office. That is prosecutable based on private conduct. The conspiracy centrally embraced private actors agreeing with petitioner to achieve his private end through private means. In particular, petitioner is alleged to have conspired with 4 private attorneys and a private political consultant in his effort as a candidate to subvert the election results. For example, petitioner turned to a private attorney who was willing to spread knowingly false claims of election fraud to spearhead his challenges to the election results. Petitioner conspired with another private attorney who caused the filing in court of a verification signed by petitioner that contained false allegations to support a challenge. 3 private actors, 2 attorneys, including one mentioned above, and a political consultant, helped implement a plan to submit fraudulent slates of presidential electors to obstruct the certification proceeding, and petitioner and a co-conspirator attorney directed that effort. Petitioner confirmed that he acted in a private capacity by seeking First Amendment protection for his false speech and moving to dismiss the entire indictment on that basis. The district court correctly held that the petitioner's false speech in furtherance of the charged conspiracies is not constitutionally protected, but petitioner's assertion of private First Amendment rights speaks volumes about the private character of the charged offenses. That petitioner also engaged in official conduct that was intertwined with his private means of attaining the conspiracy's aim should not immunize all of his conduct. No valid claim of blanket immunity should attach to a non-immune conspiracy committed with private actors through private conduct to obtain a private end simply because a former president also used official powers to further the conspiracy. 2. If the court were to find that some form of immunity from criminal prosecution for a former president's official acts exists, that immunity should not preclude all evidentiary uses of official acts in a trial based on petitioner's purely private conduct. His interactions with government officials or actions in his official capacity would still be admissible to prove. For example, petitioner's knowledge or notice of the falsity of his election fraud claims. That evidentiary use parallels the established rule in comparable contexts. For instance, the First Amendment prohibits criminalizing most speech or other protected expression, but it does not prohibit the evidentiary use of speech, including to prove motive or intent. Through evidentiary rulings and instructions to the jury, the district court can make clear that evidence concerning any protected official acts is to be considered only for the proper purpose for which it was admitted. And if petitioner objects to such rulings, he can seek appellate review if necessary after final judgment. Conclusion. The judgment of the Court of Appeals should be affirmed. Consistent with the court's expedited treatment of this case, the government respectfully requests that the court issue the opinion and a certified copy of the judgment forthwith. Respectfully submitted, Jack Smith, Special Counsel, April 2024. We've come to the end of this brief. Until next episode, thanks for listening to What SCOTUS Wrote Us.